The Bull of Rome. Chapter 8. The Bull in Germany. While the reformer was thus addressing the Roman pontiff for the last time, the bull which anathematized him was already in the hands of the chiefs of the German church, and at the threshold of Luther's dwelling place. It would appear that no doubts were entertained at Rome of the success of the step just taken against the Reformation. The Pope had commissioned two high functionaries of his court, Caraccioli and Aleander, to bear it to the Archbishop of Mentz, desiring him to see it put in execution. But Eck himself appeared in Saxony as the herald and agent of the great pontifical work. The choice had long been doubtful. Eck, wrote an inhabitant of Rome about this time, was peculiarly adapted for this mission by his impudence, his dissimulation, his lies, his flattery, and other vices that are held in high esteem at Rome, but his fondness for drinking, a failing towards which the Italians entertain a great aversion, was rather against his election. The influence, however, of his patron Fugger, the King of Crowns, prevailed in the end. This bad habit was even metamorphosed into a virtue in the ease of Dr. Eck. "He is just the man we want," said many of the Romans. "For these drunken Germans, what can be better than a drunken legate? Their temerity can only be checked by an equal degree of temerity." Further, it was whispered about that no man of sincerity and good sense would understand such a mission, and that even could such a man be found, the magnitude of the danger would soon make him abandon the place. The idea of nominating Aleander as Dr. Eck's colleague seemed most excellent. "A worthy pair of ambassadors," said some. "Both are admirably suited for this work, and perfectly matched in effrontery, impudence, and debauchery." The doctor of Ingolstadt had felt more than any other man the force of Luther's attack. He had seen the danger, and stretched forth his hand to steady the tottering edifice of Rome. He was, in his own opinion, the Atlas destined to bear on his sturdy shoulders the ancient Roman world now threatening to fall to ruins. Proud of the success of his journey to Rome, proud of the commission he had received from the sovereign pontiff, proud of appearing in Germany with the new title of Protonotary and Pontifical Nuncio, proud of the bull he held in his hands, and which contained the condemnation of his indomitable rival, his present mission was a more magnificent triumph than all the victories he had gained in Hungary, Bavaria, Lombardy, and Saxony, and from which he had previously derived so much renown. But this pride was soon to be brought low. The Pope, by confiding the publication of the bull to Eck, had committed a fault destined to destroy its effect. So great a distinction, accorded to a man not filling an elevated station in the church, offended all sensible men. The bishops, accustomed to receive the bulls direct from the Roman pontiff, were displeased that this should be published in their diocese by a nuncio created for the occasion. The nation that had laughed at the pretended conqueror at Leipzig at the moment of his flight to Italy was astonished and indignant at seeing him recross the Alps, bearing the insignia of a papal nuncio, and furnished with power to crush her chosen men. Luther considered this judgment brought by his implacable opponent as an act of personal revenge. This condemnation was in his idea, says Pallavicini, the treacherous dagger of a mortal enemy, and not the lawful acts of a Roman lictor. This paper was no longer regarded as the bull of the supreme pontiff, but as the bull of Dr. Eck. Thus the edge was blunted and weakened beforehand by the very man who had prepared it. The Chancellor of Ingolstadt had made all haste to Saxony. 'Twas there he had fought. 'Twas there he wished to publish his victory. He succeeded in posting up the bull at Meissen, Merseburg, and Brandenburg, towards the end of September. But in the first of these cities it was stuck up in a place where no one could read it, and the bishops of the three sees did not press its publication. Even his great protector, Duke George, forbade the Council of Leipzig to make it generally known before receiving an order from the Bishop of Merseburg, and this order did not come till the following year. "These difficulties are merely for form's sake," thought John Eck at first, for everything in other respects seemed to smile upon him. Duke George himself sent him a gilt cup filled with ducats. Even Miltitz, who had hastened to Leipzig at the news of his rival's presence, invited him to dinner. The two legates were boon companions, and Miltitz thought he could more effectually sound his rival over the bottle. "When he had drunk pretty freely, he began," says the Pope's chamberlain, "to boast at a fine rate. He displayed his bull, and related how he intended bringing that scoundrel Martin to reason." But ere long the Ingolstadt doctor observed that the wind was changing. A great alteration had taken place in Leipzig during the past year. On St. Michael's Day, some students posted up placards in 10 different places, in which the new nuncio was sharply attacked. In alarm, he fled to the cloister of St. Paul, in which Tetzel had already taken refuge, refused to see anyone, and prevailed upon the rector to bring these youthful adversaries to account. But poor Eck gained little by this. The students wrote a ballad upon him, which they sung in the streets. Eck heard it from his retreat. Upon this he lost all his courage. The formidable champion trembled in every limb. Each day he received threatening letters. 150 students arrived from Wittenberg, boldly exclaiming against the papal envoy. The wretched apostolical nuncio could hold out no longer. "I have no wish to see him killed," said Luther, "but I am desirous that his schemes should fail." Eck quitted his asylum by night, escaped secretly from Leipzig, and went and hid himself at Coburg. Miltitz, who relates this, boasted of it more than the reformer. This triumph was not of long duration. All the conciliatory plans of the chamberlain failed, and he came to a melancholy end. Miltitz, being intoxicated, fell into the Rhine at Mentz and was drowned. Gradually, however, Eck's courage revived. He repaired to Erfurt, whose theologians had given the Wittenberg doctor several proofs of their jealousy. He insisted that the bull should be published in the city, but the students seized the copies, tore them in pieces, and flung the fragments into the river, saying, "Since it is a bull, a bubble, let it float." "No," said Luther, when he was informed of this. "The Pope's paper is a real bull bubble." Eck did not dare to appear at Wittenberg. He sent the bull to the rector, threatening to destroy the university if he did not conform to it. At the same time he wrote to Duke John, Frederick's brother and co-regent. "Do not misconstrue my proceedings," said he, "for I am fighting on behalf of the faith, which costs me much care, toil, and money." The Bishop of Brandenburg could not, even had he so wished, act in Wittenberg in his quality of ordinary, for the university was protected by its privileges. Luther and Karlstadt, both condemned by the bull, were invited to be present at the deliberations that took place on its contents. The rector declared that as the bull was not accompanied by a letter from the Pope, he would not publish it. The university already enjoyed in the surrounding countries a greater authority than the pontiff himself. Its declaration served as a model for the elector's government. Thus the spirit that was in Luther triumphed over the bull of Rome. While this affair was thus violently agitating the public mind in Germany, a solemn voice was heard in another country of Europe. One man, foreseeing the immense schism that the papal bull would cause in the church, stood forward to utter a serious warning and to defend the reformer. It was the same Swiss priest whom we have mentioned before, Ulrich Zwingli, who, without any relations of friendship with Luther, published a writing full of wisdom and dignity, the first of his numerous works. A brotherly affection seemed to attract him towards the reformer of Wittenberg. "The piety of the pontiff," said he, "calls upon him to sacrifice gladly all that he holds dearest, for the glory of Christ his King and the public peace of the Church. Nothing is more injurious to his dignity than his defending it by bribery or by terror. Before even Luther's writings had been read, he was cried down among the people as a heretic, a schismatic, and as Antichrist himself. No one had given him warning, no one had refuted him. He begged for a discussion, and they were content to condemn him. The bull that is now published against him displeases even those who honor the Pope's grandeur, for throughout it betrays signs of the impotent hatred of a few monks, and not those becoming the mildness of a pontiff, the vicar of a savior full of compassion. All men acknowledge that the true doctrine of the gospel of Jesus Christ has greatly degenerated, and that we need a striking public revival of laws and morality. Look to all men of learning and virtue. The greater their sincerity, the stronger is their attachment to the evangelical truth, and the less are they scandalized at Luther's writings. There is no one but confesses that these books have made him a better man, although perhaps they may contain passages that he does not approve of. Let men of pure doctrine and acknowledged probity be chosen. Let those princes above all suspicion, the Emperor Charles, the King of England, and the King of Hungary, themselves appoint the arbitrators. Let these men read Luther's writings, hear him personally, and let their decision be ratified. Nich sato e tu Christopedea chi aletheia. This proposition emanating from the country of the Swiss led to no results. The great divorce must be accomplished, Christendom must be rent in twain, and even in its wounds will the remedy for all its ills be found.